It was a cold, bleak spring day on the 24th of April 2015 that I stood along with hundreds of others at the junction of a road about 5 or 6 miles from Ypres between the villages of St Julian, Pokepel and Langemarck. These places are immortal in the history of the Great War. The King of Belgium was in attendance at the ceremony that was about to take place. There was a choir there, school children, and they sang to the King of Belgium. As for the case with most of these events, the last post was played. The Canadian and German ambassadors were there. Wreaths were laid. Words were said, and we stood in silence as we always do. Local people attended, people from the UK on organised tours, perhaps relative of the men that fought in this small corner of Belgium. As the clock approached 5 o'clock, we all stood and thought about what had happened at this very point, 100 years ago to that very minute. This junction is now known as Vancouver Corner, and it was the place exactly 100 years before that the Canadians held the line after the Germans had used poison gas for the first time. And as we stood there, none of us could take our eyes off the imposing memorial that stood above us, 11 metres high. Anyone that's been to the Ypres Salient will know the memorial that I'm talking about. Known as the Brooding Soldier, it's visible from miles around, and it stands at the very point that the Canadians withstood that German attack that spring afternoon all those years ago. For many people, this is their favourite, if that's the right word, memorial of all of those on the Western Front. It's a single shaft of granite. But what we always remember as we approach this junction, when we look up that 11 metres, we see the bowed head and shoulders of a Canadian soldier with folded hands resting on arms reversed. His rifle upside down, that means. The expression on the face of the soldier beneath his steel helmet. It's resolute, it's determined, but it's also sympathetic. We can look into his face, as I often do when I go there, and just imagine what he's been through and what he's thinking of. The statue itself is set in the middle of a beautiful garden surrounded by tall cedar trees. And the memorial itself was unveiled on the 8th of July 1923 by His Royal Highness the Duke of Connaught. There were many veterans that were there, including the former commander-in-chief of the entire Allied force, Marshal Ferdinand Foch. He made a speech. He said the Canadians paid heavily for their sacrifice, and the corner of earth on which the memorial of gratitude rises has been bathed in their blood. They wrote here the first page in that book of glory, which is the history of their participation in the war. And there we were, all those years later, just where those veterans had stood, 8 years after their action on the crossroads there. We were thinking of them, as they thought of their comrades that had laid down their lives to try and defend the city of Ypres. This was the Second Battle of Ypres, the opening stages of the Second Battle of Ypres. And in this week's podcast that I, Terry Wenham, called Tales from the Battlefields, we want to concentrate on exactly what happened at this point, maybe a few hundred yards around, on that day, the 22nd of April 1915. We also want to find out who the architect was, the man that came up with the design for the Brooding Soldier. And as usual, we'll go into the archives, to the newspaper archives, and we'll discover the individual stories of many of the soldiers that fought here, and we'll hear the stories through their own words rather than the history books. At the base of the memorial, there's a plaque, and on that plaque, in capitals, it says this column marks the battlefield where 18,000 Canadians on the British left withstood the first German gas attack, the 22nd to the 24th of April 1915. 2,000 fell and lie buried nearby. Now, of course, there were Canadians there. Canada was still a very young country at the time, and many, many of those men that fought and fell there had actually come from the United Kingdom. They'd emigrated to Canada for all sorts of reasons. In the research that I've done, we discover that many of them had Scottish heritage. So who was the architect that came up with this extraordinary moving memorial? His name was Frederick Chapman Clemesher, and he'd served with the Canadian Army on the Western Front in 1918, and he'd been slightly wounded by a gunshot wound to his cheek during the 100-day offensive in August of 1918. He was an Englishman by birth. He'd been born in 1876 in Preston in Lancashire, but he'd emigrated to Canada in the early 20th century, and he became an architect, and his business partner, a man called Francis Portnell, also served alongside him in the 46th Battalion of the Canadian Expeditionary Force. Clemesher attested on the 15th of September 1915. He was at that stage 39 years old, and on the 22nd of October 1915, he sailed to England, and it wasn't until August 1916 that he arrived with the 46th Battalion in France. As I mentioned just now, he was wounded in August 1918. Must have only been a minor injury, because after spending a few days in hospital at Rouen, in an army base hospital there, he rejoined his unit on the 19th of August. And he was demobbed in April of 1919. And he went back to Regina in Canada, where he lived with his wife and three-year-old son. He went back to being an architect. And in 1920, his business partner encouraged him to take part in a competition to design memorials that were to be built in Belgium and France to commemorate the great battles that the Canadian had been involved in during the war. There were 160 entrants, and they were whittled down to 17 finalists who prepared final drawings and models. And the main one, the most famous one, was to design the Vimy Ridge Memorial, and that was won by a man called Walter Allwood from Toronto. Clemesher's design, it came second, and it was decided that his brooding soldier design would be built at Ypres, on the very location that the Canadians had withstood that German attack. In 1922, Clemesher travelled over to Ypres to oversee the construction of the monument, and it was only a year later when it was opened, as I said, in July 1923, and that's 13 years before the Vimy Memorial, of course, that was much bigger, was unveiled. It was the peak, really, of Clemesher's career as an architect. He didn't enter any more competitions, and afterwards he emigrated to California, and he never returned to Canada. What a legacy he left behind, and it was that legacy that took us there in 2015. And of course, I've been there many times since, and I'm sure a lot of people listening to this have as well. It's not quite the end of the story as far as Clemesher is concerned, because in July 1946, so about a year after the Second World War had finished, the Canadian Battlefields Memorials Commission was surprised to hear from him, because they hadn't heard from him in nearly 25 years. And Clemesher wanted to know whether the memorial had been damaged during the Nazi occupation of France. Well, not only had it not been damaged, he was delighted to hear, but trees had grown up, and it was almost like a memorial park that we see today. And that made him relieved, I suppose, as well as pleased, because he thought that the original site was somewhat stark, and with trees grown there, it would give it a more pleasant effect. So what did it look like at the end of the war? Well, in 1917, it was a very dangerous place to be during the Third Battle of Ypres, Battle of Passchendaele. It was quoted as being a featureless waste of dead men, mules, tanks and shell holes linked together with 5 feet of water in each. Triangle Farm stood, solid with concrete and steel like a tooth decayed on its root, with other German pillboxes in line. These were the words written by Henry Williamson, the man famous for writing Tartar the Otter. He visited in 1964 and he wrote an article in the Evening Standard. It described the memorial itself. He said, for the bowed head and soldiers with reversed arms emerging from the top of the tall stone column has the gravity and strength of grief coming from the full knowledge of old wrongs done to men by men. But it mourns for all mankind. The genius of man rises out of the stone, and once again our tears fell upon the battlefield. It occurs to me whilst reading that, that this place really was hell on earth, both on that spring day in 1915 with the gas attack, and then again during that third Battle of Ypres, as the British this time attacked the Germans. But in those dreadful conditions, it rained and rained and rained, didn't it, in August. But that's not what we've come to talk about today. We're going to look at what happened on this very spot through the eyes of the soldiers. So let's start, shall we? And we'll start by using the famous 1964 BBC broadcast that they called The Great War. And it contains a couple of eyewitness accounts of what happened at 5 o'clock on that day.
But it was the Germans who attacked on April the 22nd. Their purpose was to cover up their troop movements away from the Western Front to Gorlice-Tarnów. Against the French sector at Ypres, they let loose a hideous new weapon, which science had added to the German soldiers' armory. Poison gas.
At about 4 o'clock in the afternoon, there was a very heavy bombardment started. And a little later on, we saw the effects of this. The first thing was hundreds of French troops running away. They were just like ants. They weren't sticking to roads or paths or anything else. They were all over the fields and breaking through hedges and everything. No arms, they'd all gone. And clutching their throats and saying, gaz, gaz, and so on.
We tried to rally them as they got level with us and they wouldn't stay. And all we got from them was alley man, bum bum, malad, malad. And they kept going and we got orders to turn around and shoot them, which we did, run away from us. And momentarily, we looked in here, we saw this green cloud coming along the ground.
The gas attack made a gap in the Allied lines 4.5 miles across. The Canadians were thrown into the breach, and for 3 weeks they held on alongside British and French troops and braved the new horror.
One chap had his hand blown off, and his wrist was fumbling around, tearing at his throat.
The effect of this gas was to form a sort of foamy liquid in one's lungs and more or less in time drown one, if you were unlucky. Because a lot of the men died pretty quickly. Others were soon down, dying. They were in fact drowning from this beastly foam coming up from their lungs.
There must have been 200 or 300 men, and they were wriggling and reeling in all positions, tearing at their throats, their faces black. And an RAMC sergeant, he stood by there, and I've never seen a man look so despondent. He says, look at the poor bastards. He said, we can't do anything for them.
A young German officer wrote,
the effects of the successful gas attack were horrible. I do not like the idea of poisoning men. Of course, the entire world will rage about it at first, and then imitate us.
This was the day when the last vestige of glamour and glory went out of war. Behind its ancient moat and ramparts, Ypres itself became a symbol of resistance and unstinted sacrifice. The great German shells set the town ablaze. Centuries of history crumbled at each blast.
But on a sudden, fierce destruction came, tigerishly pouncing. Thunderbolt and flame showered on her streets to shatter them and toss her ancient towers to ashes.
The shelling had started again in Ypres, and by the time we got up, marching up to the town, it looked as though the whole place was on fire. Buildings right and left of us were blazing away, and the heat was so intense in some of the narrow streets that as we were marching up in column of four, the men on the flanks had to creep into the middle to avoid the blistering heat, and one could see the haggard desolation on their faces as they also...
The German attacks at Ypres rammed home the terrible lesson. This was a new kind of war, a war of engineering and chemistry and industrial power.
Indeed, it was to become, as we know, the first fully industrialised war in history, and it was to have such a terrible effect on the combatants and the non-combatants, as we started to hear there, the refugees that were affected directly. It must have been a tremendous shock for them as their homes came under fire from the air, from artillery, and also the gas smell that had found its way back to Ypres and beyond. So what I want to do now is have a look at, as we often do, the personal stories of the lads that were there, in this case the Canadians. And the first one I've got here is a letter that was sent by a man called Percy Kingsley, who came from Ontario in Canada. And he joined up in August 1914 at the age of 28. And like so many others, he did his best to stay in touch with family and friends back home. And he wrote his letters very carefully so that the people at home didn't worry too much and he didn't document too much his experiences of the horror and the cold and the fear that they must have experienced. But there is one letter that is the exception. And he wrote it on June the 26th, 1915, so 2 months after the gas attack. And it was addressed to someone called Miss Hanley. Now, we don't know who Miss Hanley was, but this is what he said in his letter. Your letter of the 11th was received last night. This is the first Canadian mail I've received in over 2 months. A lot of our mail was burned and blown up at Ypres. Well, I think I must have a charmed life. At least I'm a very lucky fellow to be here at all. I went to France on February the 9th and went into the trenches at Armentieres on February the 18th. We were in the front line for 2 days, in reserve and digging trenches for several days. It was not very busy then, although we lost a few men with shellfire and snipers. Now that's an important part of the history really, because with many of these units that went over to the Western Front, they were sent to what was known as the Quiet Area, the area just inside the French border where it connects with Belgium, probably about 10 or 15 miles south of Ypres, around Armentieres. And this was effectively a nursery area where raw units and troops, like Private Kingsley, could get used to being in the trenches. They could continue their training and, most importantly, learn how to survive. He says, during our stay in that area, we lost about 100 men, which was giving us a taste of the real war. We were relieved by a British division and went out of the line for 21 days. He said they then transferred to the Ypres salient just behind the lines at Steenvoorde. He said little did we know what was before us. On Thursday, April the 14th, we moved through the famous town of Ypres. Although Ypres had been shelled, the civilians were still living there. Stores were open and lighted up the night as we passed through and looked real homelike. On April the 15th, we relieved the 10th Battalion. The trenches had been held by French troops and were in a really bad condition. The next morning at dawn, we had the first view of our surroundings. Just over the parapet, about 40 yards away, lay 300 dead Germans who'd been lying there since last October. And when the sun rose, believe me, the stench was simply awful. Also in our trench, there were hundreds of Germans and French just buried about a foot deep. And you could not dig to improve the trench without striking a dead body. So just think of that. This was his first experience of the Ypres salient. He'd experienced death and wounding and no doubt mutilation around Armentieres a few weeks before. But just imagine that, looking over the parapet and seeing in no man's land the putrefying, decaying corpses of 300 dead Germans who were, let's remember, human beings. And they'd been there right through the winter, so they must have frozen. And then by April, thawed out, no doubt eaten away by the rats and the birds and the other vermin. What an incredible sight that must have been for this young man. He said, the first 2 nights I slept on a grave containing a number of dead Germans, and they were so near the surface that the ground would spring up and down like dough, and oh, that smell. That was the last sleep I had for 7 days and nights. On the morning of April the 22nd, as you know, the great German attack began. They turned the gas on the French Algerian troops, who held the trenches on our left, and they retired in disorder, leaving 4,000s of the yards of the line open, and this left the Canadian division cut off. We extended at right angles to our line and blocked the German advance. It was here that our boys were gassed badly, and it was here that 8,000 of us held 60,000 Germans for 22 hours, without supports and under the most terrific shell fire during this war. Just fancy shells of all kinds bursting over, and around at 100 per minute, and you'll have some idea of it. It is marvellous how anyone ever lived under it. Well, he's asking his family, or whoever the reciprocate of this letter was, this lady that we don't know who she was, to try and imagine what it was like to be under shell fire. Well, I can't. I don't know about you. Maybe it went something like this. As Percy said, with hundreds of shells being fired at them at the same time, it was impossible to determine the sound of individual shells. He said our artillery was put out of action. It was the charge of the 10th Battalion to recover a battery that poor Joe Pinnett was killed. He was killed by a bullet through the brain within 20 yards of our trench. Poor Joe, he did not suffer though. They always say that, don't they? They always say that the death was instantaneous, that the soldier died bravely and that he didn't suffer. We know, of course, that that probably wasn't the case for the vast majority of them. Joseph Pinnett was 28 years old and he has no known grave and is remembered, like so many of them, on the Menin Gate Memorial. Well, to make a long story short, he continues, we were there for 5 days and nights without food, and when relieved, some of our boys could hardly walk. Our losses were terrible, and the sights I saw I shall never forget. To give you some idea of the slaughter, our brigade went in over 5,000 strong and came out 1,200 in number. When we were finally relieved, we marched back through Ypres to relieve trenches guarding the Saar Canal and bridges for 6 days. Here we lost 77 men by shell fire, and we were 4 miles from the firing line. When we came back through Ypres, the Germans were shelling it, and destruction was something awful. There were dead men, women, children and soldiers lying all over the city, and I don't think there was a house in the town that had not been ruined. It was an awful shambles. The dead were piled in houses and fired and burned. After 6 days here, listening to Jack Johnson's and coal boxes, they were high explosive shells, bursting and dodging shrapnel, we went to billets 4 miles on the other side of Balliol for 10 days. The war is still raging the same as ever, and I think it will be at least 1 year before it is over. Well, bye-bye, yours truly, Percy. The year will go on for another year, he said. Little did he know that it was to be another 3.5 years before the hostilities would finally come to an end, and there was much slaughter ahead for all of the combatant nations, and also the Canadians. You remember in that letter, Kingsley said that he felt he had a charmed life. Well, in 1922, he married Margaret. They had 3 daughters, and he lived a very long and successful life. And he died in 1982, aged 96. No doubt he never forgot what happened in those few days near Ypres in 1915. Private Wilfred Maughan was another of those that was there, and he wrote a letter to his uncle. He'd been wounded in the fighting at Ypres, and he wrote this letter from his hospital bed in Bristol in the United Kingdom. He'd had a bullet wound in his thigh. He said, "What a terrible time we've had lately. I'm lucky to get through it alive. Not many of my chums did. In fact, we only had 100 left after the charge about which you have read. I heard there was only about 20 of us left on the Saturday. You'll see we had a lively time. I was operated on this afternoon and had the bullet extracted from my leg. It was a round lead shrapnel shell bullet, and it went right through the fleshy part of the limb, close to the thigh, so there's a nice hole now. It was Thursday night, April the 22nd. We'd been in Ypres 3 days, acting as reserves, when we received word that the Germans were advancing. We got ready, having only our overcoats and pouches on. We left our packs, as we thought we would be back for them after a few hours. We doubled out through a hail of shrapnel and other shells and got on the road to St. Julian. Here we smelt those stink bombs. Beastly things they are. They hurt the eyes. In fact, you think you're going blind. After a while, our eyes either got better or we got used to it. We ran for about 3 miles and then we waited till it was dark. Word came to deploy, that is, to form a straight line parallel to the Germans. We were told they were in a wood, so we got ready to charge. We rushed within 300 yards of their trench, and there was a silence that could be felt, as all firing seemed to have ceased. Presently, a star shell went up, and a perfect hail of machine gun and rifle fire was let loose on us. It seemed to be raining bullets. Immediately, we all dropped till the firing eased a little, and we rushed to the trench. We certainly slaughtered some Germans there, but we lost a lot of men too. We had hand-to-hand fight in the woods and we chased the enemy for about a mile, but we had to fall back to their trench again as we had no men and no reinforcements. I got through it all right and I carried 3 of my chums back to the dressing station during the night. There we fixed up the trench for a counter-attack. About 5 o'clock on the Friday morning, I was creeping behind our trench as we were ordered to get together again when a shell burst overhead. I felt something strike me on the leg, but I did not think it was a bullet. I was only stunned, and not till about tea time did I discover I'd been wounded. I bandaged up the leg with the help of a comrade. Here I lay until 10 p.m, 17 hours altogether, and I was sniped at and shelled all the time. At last I was able to crawl to the dressing station, about 1/4 mile away, after being taken to the headquarters dressing station at a barn, round which the enemy shells continued to fall. In the afternoon, the Germans made another violent attack and drove our gallant boys back a little further. The doctor, therefore, gave orders for our removal to a safer place. 4 stretcher bearers took me in hand and carried me 3 miles, and then a motor ambulance came along and took me to safety. These stretcher bearers are brave men. The Germans fired on us during the whole of that 3-mile tramp. It is awfully nice, isn't it, to be helpless and have someone firing at you. But the stretcher bearers kept going, taking no notice of the falling shells. It was a cool, heroic performance, and the experience was one I shall never forget. I think what I took from reading that account is that he's been wounded, and in my mind, that's it for you. The battle, the war may be over. You've got a blighty wound and you're going to be safe. But no. He's lay there for many, many hours. He must have been scared, maybe hungry, thirsty, and still the shells and the bullets are dropping around him and he fears for his life. And then even as they make their way out of the battle zone and back to a dressing station, he's still not safe and he's not in control either. He's in the hands of these, as he calls them, brave stretcher bearers. So many of them died carrying casualties out of the line. He owes his life to them, and as he said, he probably never knew who they were, but he never forgot them. Private George Stratton was another one of those that had emigrated to Canada and joined the Canadian Army. He was serving with the Royal Canadian Highlanders, and then he'd been transferred to the 3rd Divisional Engineers of Canada. He was there, and he described it as a never-to-be-forgotten Thursday when we were shelled in our quarters and had to abandon everything. He said the Germans shelled the farm that we were sheltering in, killing hundreds more and setting the barn on fire where our poor wounded fellows were. I cannot dwell on the scene, but we moved what we could regardless of the enemy's fire. The next day we got orders to advance and dig a trench in an open field. The Germans discovered us and turned their machine guns on us, mowing us down like corn. Fortunately, I did not get a scratch. My pals were falling right and left. It was wholesale murder. After it was dark, we buried our dead, and a solemn time it was. We sheltered in a barn, but we'd not been there long before a shell came through the roof and killed 3 more. Very nearly all of the 1st Canadian contingent are gone, and my old regiment is nearly wiped out. But they died fighting. I thought my chum I fetched home was killed, but he's safe. Our losses reached thousands of men. It's been terrible, and the cries from the battlefield are awful, as thousands are lying about. We lost 75% of our company. Fighting is still going on, and we are expecting to be called out at any minute. We were relieved 2 days ago, and a lot of my pals have been taken to hospital with their nerves gone. They had to give us rum to make us sleep as our nerves were so shaken. The Germans fire those big Jack Johnson shells and they kill hundreds. The sights around here are awful.
One huge heap is nothing but corpses. Whatever is going to happen, I do not know. Our major is a brick, and I'm glad he did not get hit, as he's such a good man and looks after us as if we were his own boys. He said to us several times, "Now, boys, be ready to do your best." It really was a marvel that we did not all get killed. One night I saw in the wood, when we were there after the wounded, I can never forget, there was a Canadian Highlander with his bayonet thrust through a German officer, and the officer with a revolver clutched in his hand. No doubt the officer shot as the bayonet went through him, and both died together. The Germans are a murderous lot. We brought some prisoners in the other night, and I'm afraid they would not have lived if some of the boys had had their way. It is fearful to think of the hearts that will be broken over this turmoil, but the real truth will never be known. Again, that's a thought that often goes through my mind as we sit here reading these accounts and listening to the words of the interviews with these veterans. How could they begin to explain to newspaper reporters, their families, or anyone that wasn't there, what it was like to be under that murderous shellfire, as he called it? And that's why I suppose those comrades association got together regularly until probably the 1960s, because this was the only opportunity for the men to be able to discuss what happened, because they'd know what happened. They're the only people to know what happened, because they were there. They could look into each other's eyes and sympathise and remember what it must have been like to be at Ypres in 1915 or 1917 or on the Somme or at Arras or any of these other conflicts. There's no way that we will ever know, no matter how many podcasts or books we'll read. Only they will know, and now, of course, they've all taken their thoughts and stories to their own graves. But I suppose that's what makes this subject so intriguing. We try and understand, don't we? And whilst trying to understand, whilst we never will, we're remembering those lads, remembering what they gave up so that we could live the lives that we do now. And whilst I'm reading those words and recording the podcast, I think back to the many times that I've stood looking up at the brooding soldier, the soldier with that sorrowful face, leaning on his upturned rifle. What was that architect thinking when he designed that impressive memorial? Was he thinking the words and the thoughts that those soldiers are telling us in this podcast? It's very peaceful there now. It's a busy junction, but you can lose yourself in your own thoughts looking up at the brooding soldier. But I urge you as you do so to think of the words that we're reading in this week's podcast. I know I will next time I go back there. There are many accounts, personal accounts, that I've read about what happened on that day, what we now call Vancouver Corner. One talks about a captain of the 13th of the Canadian Expeditionary Force, 13th Battalion. It says the officer was seriously wounded, and when an immediate withdrawal was ordered, he refused to let his men burden themselves with a maimed man. In other words, he didn't want his men to be slowed down as they withdrew by taking him along. His last request that they should give him two loaded Colt revolvers to add to his own one, and they left him in that abandoned trench waiting to sell his own life. In a Scottish newspaper dated May the 1st, 1915, I found this poem that was written by Robert J. Devine. He's never going to win any awards for poetry. Just listen to the words that come from his heart. He says, "Our thanks go out to you, lads. We scarce know what to say. You showed what you could do, lads. You gallantly saved the day. We want you all to know, lads, that we feel we owe a debt to each Jack Cannock who showed his pluck in a way that we can't forget. You left your happy home, lads, with all that men hold dear. You rushed across the foam, lads, with never a thought of fear. You met your country's foe, lads, and you played him at his game. You did your part with a fearless heart and covered yourselves with fame. Never were men more brave, lads, as your actions plainly tell. Your only thought was to save, lads, the land you love so well. You've won a place in the hearts, lads, of true men everywhere. The terrible test found you at your best and ready to do your share. You wouldn't let go your guns, lads. You fought till you won them back. You proved you were Britain's sons, lads, walking in Britain's track. You stood with your face to the foe, lads. You gave him shot for shot. And side by side you fought and died and won, but was dearly bought. We mourn for the pals you lost, lads. It grieves us sore to know that they had to pay the cost, lads, of victory over the foe. But our thanks go out to you all, lads, and we'll never cease to tell how you saved your guns from the cowardly Huns in a blizzard of shot and shell. We at home raise a hearty cheer, lads, and you've given us cause for pride. But we needs must shed a tear, lads, for the brave ones who have died. We can't express what we feel, lads, we scarcely know what to say, but we'll tell with pride how you fought and died and gallantly saved the day. It's interesting, isn't it, that the writer of that poem was talking about victory in battle, and of course it wasn't a victory. I suppose it was in some ways because they held the line. Victory was only to come over 3 years later, and many more Canadians, brave Canadians, were to lay down their lives before that hard-earned victory was to come. Another letter that was written home, it was written by a man called Private Richard Cox, and he was writing from a hospital bed at Netley Hospital, a massive military hospital near Southampton. His letter is dated the 1st of May, and he writing to his mum, he says just a few lines, hoping that they may find you quite well, as I'm pleased to say this leaves me getting along fine at present. There's no need to worry, mother. I'm getting on well here. I get everything that I desire. I've got a doctor from St Thomas's Hospital in London attending me, so you can bet I'm getting on all right and the food is excellent. I was wounded in the hip. The bullet went in and came out again. I also got hit in the shoulder, but not too much, having went in the fleshy part. I'll now give you a description of what happened that day as near as possible. The whole battalion was billeted in a flour mill in Ypres. During the day, one of our officers got a wire that the building was going to be shelled that evening, so instructions were given for the battalion to leave these billets and get into others. All the battalion had left during the afternoon except two platoons. At 5 o'clock, our platoon commander gave orders to fall in. We ran upstairs to get our equipment and rifles when the Germans started shelling. The shells were bursting all around the building. It was too hot to fall in there, so we advanced along the canal bank and were about to fall in when there started the most awful shelling I've seen since we came out. They were dropping them into Ypres too fast to count. Then coming along the roads from the city could be seen men galloping their horses to get them away clear of the shell fire. Old men and women and young women. It was pitiful to see them. We got orders to fall in and then we started our advance. As we marched along to take up our position in the reserve trenches, we could see retreating soldiers in the distance. As we got closer to them, we could see they were Algerians. From there on to the reserve trenches, we passed those poor fellows lying wounded by the side of the roads. Others were being helped along by their comrades. Our soldiers were falling in all over, so then I began to suspect that the Germans must have broken through. When we reached the reserve trenches, we were each issued another 100 rounds of ammunition. Then we got the order to fix bayonets. We were waiting but a short time when instructions came along that we had to rush the Germans back from this position. We lined up in a field about 300 yards away. Then came the order to charge. We advanced in double companies. I lay there where I was, and being unable to take part, watched the boys as they charged, and believe me, they sure went ahead. It was not long before I lost sight of them. I met some of our fellows as they crawled past wounded. They told me our fellows were doing well and they got the best of the Germans. I lay on the ground an hour with my wound. Then some Germans on the left threw up star shells and started to shoot at our poor fellows lying on the ground wounded. So I told myself I'd better get out of it in some way in case they might start shooting at me on the ground too. I was bleeding pretty hard, but I managed to crawl about 300 yards where I was picked up by a couple of stretcher bearers and taken to the field dressing station. And you can bet I was glad when I got away from being under fire. I'm sure you're wondering why I didn't write yesterday. Well, dear mother, I was under chloroform yesterday getting the wound cleaned out. Everyone here in the hospital is very nice, and in fact, everything that can be desired. This is a lovely place. The grounds go right down to the sea. Now, dear mother, I think I've given you all the news, so we'll close with fondest love to yourself, and my dear Paps and Bill, and remained, as ever, your loving son, Dick. In another twist of fate, I've read in another newspaper article about an unnamed Canadian officer who'd arrived from Canada just in time to take part in this heroic defence of Ypres during the Second Battle of Ypres. But he received awful news when he arrived at Boulogne because his eldest son had been killed in action and his youngest son had been seriously wounded and was in hospital. And even worse than that, on hearing the news about the two boys, his wife and daughter followed him over to England. And how did they get to England? Well, they were on board the Lusitania. And it was the Lusitania that off the coast of Ireland had been sunk by the Germans. And their names, it says, do not appear on the list of survivors. This Canadian officer has lost all of his family except his one wounded son in just 1 week. We don't know who he was, but I wonder whether he survived the war, and if he did, what the rest of his life was like. Lance Corporal Stuart Stoddard, serving with the 90th Winnipeg Rifles, wrote to his uncle and gave a description of how he managed to survive the gas fumes. He said, "We saw the poison fumes being blown from the enemy trenches. When I saw it coming, a chill crept round my heart, for I realised what was approaching. The poisonous gas," I mumbled to myself, and so it was. Just then I had visions of all of us lying dead and the Huns just walking over to our trenches. It was a heavy yellow cloud and soon enveloped everything and everybody. You will understand what I mean when I tell you that it was as thick as October fog. I gripped a piece of sacking and my water bottle. The former I placed over my nose and putting the water bottle under, I kept gobbling at the contents. I was sore at heart for the other fellows. What with choking and vomiting, they were truly helpless. After a while, the stuff cleared away. The Germans started to come over their parapets, and we was far away from being absolutely dead. We gave such a volley that they went hopping back again. I never enjoyed myself so much, and the other fellows too, when they got in a shot. The Germans saw that they could do nothing and commenced shelling us again practically all day. The Canadian regiment on our left got such a dose of the fumes that they were absolutely helpless. This meant that we had to help on our left. It was an awfully warm day, and about 11 o'clock we were told to hang on to the trenches. Reinforcements are coming. This was told to us two or three times during the day, and in midst of the shooting I would turn round and scan the horizons for the reinforcements. But hardly anybody of men could live through that such a storm of shrapnel. We hurried on, but my heart went down further when a staggering messenger said that the Germans were breaking through in their thousands. At 11 o'clock at night, a regular regiment came and helped us. In the morning, another regiment who had marched for 12 hours came and relieved us. We never retired. We got out of the trench. It was raining hard, but got shelled with machine guns. We'd laid low in a turnip field for a long time, and at last we all got broken up and scattered. We got away with five other fellows and got into a barn. The country was being absolutely swept by shells. On Monday and Tuesday, we all got together, what was left of us, and helped to attack again. We were under shell fire all the time. Every moment we stopped, we had to dig ourselves in. We were at present in a cornfield, having made a comfortable little dugout. We were being reorganised and had a big batch of Canadians from England to fill up vacancies. I never got a good deal of the fumes. It never affected me. I think of the goblin of the water did the trick. Some of our fellows had gone crazy and a number had died. I never felt better in my life. It was awfully hot at present and we were getting as brown as berries. I often wondered what I'd feel like in a battle. Most of our fellows were not too bad with the fumes. and they were smoking cigarettes. I had two cigarettes left over. I lit one, but it was swept away by a bullet. I had some narrow escapes. What gets me when I read that, he's talking about it quite cheerfully, isn't he? I suppose he's thinking of his family back home. He's writing, as I said, to his uncle, who was living in Scotland, in Inverness. Of course, it was a shock to the Canadians to have to face gas. They didn't imagine that this would happen to them. And one newspaper correspondent reported that tolerance of the enemy changes to bitterness. He said the poisonous gases of Ypres have completely changed the tolerant point of view in which the enemy had been held and have affected not the victims of these unparalleled crimes only, but the whole army. A deep and bitter loathing of the Germans and of everything German has spread through the ranks, and our soldiers realise at last the shameless character of the enemy. People at home need not trouble themselves with squeamish hesitations. It is from the rank and file in particular that the demand comes with the most insistence and force. The last resource of German cowardice would unfallingly result in the war having fought with a bitterness hitherto undreamed of. Strong and urgent demands on all sides are heard for the immediate deportation from England to Germany of every single German subject unfit to bear arms. It is not understood why the English at home can still allow Germans to go about amongst them, whilst their compatriots poison water and air and inflict upon our soldiers the most horrible atrocities. And he was talking so early on in the war about German people, many of them that lived and worked in the United Kingdom. And after this and the sinking of the Lusitania, of course, attitudes changed towards Germany and they didn't deport them. Many of them were interned in camps and held prisoner for the duration of the war. Another Canadian soldier said that after the fighting, morning broke through and dispersed the darkness of the night and everything was silent. As I stood looking over the battlefield of the night before, the birds burst forth into song from the weed in front. What a contrast, peace, gladness, tranquility and life on the one side of our trench and the war, pain and death on the other. Tears welled up in my eyes as I listened to the birdsong of praise and I saw my comrades lying among the grass as they'd fallen in the fight. Another veteran here describes the awful conditions. He said, we formed up at dusk and marched over broken ground into trenches that led us to a sloping hill with the vague outlines of trees near it. As we neared, silence was ordered and unexpectedly we found ourselves filling a trench that was already crammed with those men we relieved. But they were battered and broken, and as we filled up the narrow trench that we were to occupy for barely a few hours, we could not help treading as we went on wounded and dying men. To this day I shall remember those cries of the wounded as they begged us not to leave them behind when we went. As I turned a bend, I trod on a figure heaped up in a shadow. He cried out in agony. I could think of nothing that could conceivably be said to him, for in such a case there was nothing to say, and I had to press on, for the Germans were hardly 70 yards away, and such was the confusion of the relief that, had they turned machine guns on the trenches, we'd have been shot like rabbits. It was a matter of life and death to us, and the wounded had to give way to our prime consideration of the whole and the living. We did indeed attempt to get back all the wounded we could, but any hint to the Germans that we were abandoning the salient and a storm of artillery would have torn up the roads and caught us in the open. This final account was written by a man who will forever be associated with the Second Battle of Ypres for reasons that I'll explain at the end. And he wrote this. Along the road, which was constantly shelled on spec by the Germans, we saw all the sights of war. Wounded men, limping or carried, ambulances, trains of supply, troops, army mules and tragedies. I saw one bicycle orderly. A shell exploded and he seemed to pedal on for 8 or 10 revolutions and then collapsed in a heap, dead. Straggling soldiers would be killed or wounded, horses also, until it got to be a nightmare. I used to shudder every time I saw wagons or troops on that road. My dugout looked out on it, I got a square hole, 8x8, dug in the side of the hill, roofed over with remnants to keep out the rain, and a little sandbag parapet on the back, raised so as to prevent pieces of black-kicked shells from coming in, or prematures from our own, or the French guns for that matter. Some straw on the floor completed it. So who was that man with those words? One of the most famous and influential men that we ever talk about when it comes to visits to Ypres, because the conditions that he was describing there were what's today known as Essex Farm Cemetery. And the Canadian with those words was John McCrae, author of the famous war poem In Flanders Fields. As most people know, he died of influenza in January 1918, but he will always be remembered for the words he wrote. Having witnessed and wrote about those dreadful scenes at Ypres in April 1915.
In Flanders fields the poppies blow, between the crosses, row on row, that mark our place. And in the sky the larks, still bravely singing, fly, scarce heard amid the guns below. We are the dead. Short days ago we lived, felt dawn, saw sunset glow, loved and were loved, and now we lie in Flanders fields. Take up our quarrel with the foe. To you from failing hands we throw the torch, be yours to hold it high. If ye break faith with us who die, we shall not sleep, though poppies grow in Flanders fields.
A copy of a transcript of that poem is in a frame at the top of the stairs in my home. And every time I go to bed every night, as I head up those stairs, I look at those words and I think, and do think, of what those men went through at Ypres in 1915. So these men that died between the 22nd and the 24th of April, what happened to their bodies? Well, the area that was fought over in April 1915 became the battlefield again in 1917 on the first day of the third Battle of Ypres, Passchendaele, which we covered a few weeks ago in one of my podcast episodes. And it meant that the vast majority of those Canadians that fell have no known grave. I did a sample of 500 of the Canadian fallen between the 22nd and the 24th of April, and 90% of them have no known grave, and they're remembered on the Meningate Memorial. And of those that do have a grave, they seem to be concentrated, obviously, at Tynecott, but also in the Perth Cemetery, China Wall Cemetery, and that's just on the outskirts of Ypres. There's quite a few in there. In total, there are 2,791 Commonwealth servicemen of the First World War buried or commemorated in that cemetery. But of those, 1,369, so nearly half, are unidentified. So some of those could be the Canadians. And worse still, when it comes to unidentified burials at Poke Capel British Cemetery, there's nearly 7,500 Commonwealth servicemen buried there. And of those, an incredible 6,230 of the burials are unidentified. So once again, some of those Canadians could be the ones that are buried there beneath a headstone that says, "Known unto God." Now, as I've been researching the story of the Canadians through the newspaper archives, there's a number of reports about a crucified Canadian soldier. And it was even raised in the House of Commons with the Prime Minister, Asquith. But this seems to be one of the many myths that has come out of the Great War and was probably a propaganda story. There was definitely lots of rumours that the Germans had done this to a Canadian soldier, but no actual proof. They didn't find a crucified body after the war was over, but then the chances of that, as we know, would have been pretty slim anyway. But in 2002, Channel 4 did a documentary and they uncovered new historical evidence that if there was a crucified soldier, it was Sergeant Harry Band, of the Central Ontario Regiment. He was reported missing on the 24th of April, and he's still missing to this day. Other soldiers in his unit wrote to his sister Elizabeth to express their condolences, and a year later one of them confirmed in a letter to her that her brother had actually been crucified. We'll never know for certain, of course. That's not actual positive, definite evidence that it did happen. But what we do know is that Band did die during the Second Battle of Ypres. His body's never been recovered, and like 90% of them, he's remembered on the Meningate Memorial. As I read through the accounts in the various newspaper reports, there was lots of contradictory evidence as to what had happened, who'd been involved, how the crucifixion had been carried out. There was even one story that they had 400, the Canadians had captured 400 Germans, and they paraded them in front of the body that had been allegedly bayoneted to a barn door, and then in reprisal they executed all but 9 of those 400 German POWs. It does seem highly unlikely to me, but maybe one day we'll know the truth. So thank you once again for tuning in to the podcast Tales from the Battlefields. We've got a few special guests coming up in the next few weeks, so stay tuned and subscribe, and please would you rate and review the podcast on Spotify, Amazon Music or Apple Podcasts. That's where most people seem to download it from. That does help spread the word to other people that perhaps don't know about it at the moment. And we'd like to end, as we normally do, by remembering all of the Canadian soldiers that died in and around what we now call Vancouver Corner on those three dreadful days in April 1915 by the plane of the Last Post.